Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks, The Learning College. I'm Alex Linder and this will be Chapter 80, the concluding chapter from The Unabridged, The International Jew, The World's Foremost Problem, written by or under the name of Henry Ford by the researchers and reporters at the Dearborn Independent in Michigan back in 1920 and 21, and even a couple articles appeared in 1922, very early. This final chapter is titled An Address to Gentiles on the Jewish Problem, and chapter 79 was addressed to Jews about it, and that they need to clean up their behavior. So let's see what he says about sort of a final summary of what we've been talking about now, and then we'll give our own conclusion regarding it, and that will do it. This and every recording that we make can be found at vnnforum.com. Now, it begins with an epigraph from Lazar, who wrote a book in the 19th century, the 1800s, about Jews and anti-Semitism, so-called, in France and Europe, I believe it was. Quote, "Everywhere they wanted to remain Jews, and everywhere they were granted the privilege of establishing a state within a state. By virtue of these privileges and exemptions, and immunity from taxes, they would soon rise above the general condition of the citizens of the municipalities where they resided. They had better opportunities for trade and accumulation of wealth, whereby they excited jealousy and hatred." So before Jews were liberated, they needed papers, basically, to live anywhere. And they, of course, themselves wanted to be forced to live in ghettos. That's what their rabbis wanted, and they saw the ghetto as the most desirable part of the city. They were afraid of contamination of their people. That's why they wanted that. And that's frequently misrepresented by Christian apologists who want to claim, but are wrong, that the church defended whites against Jews. No, it defended Jews against whites. Always has, always will. It's a doctrinal problem. And so that's the epigraph from Lazar about Jews demanding special privileges, being a state within a state, and these special exemptions and special laws allowing them to get rich more easily and exciting the jealousy of others. Chapter 80, final chapter of the four-volume 80 chapter, Unabridged, The International Jew, The World's Foremost Problem, An Address to Gentiles, and he always puts Gentiles in quotes, or most of the time, on the Jewish problem, because Gentiles don't really form a group. He'll talk about that a little here, but and Gentile is a word that comes from the Jews. It's not what we call ourselves. Ford says, "The heading of this article presents difficulties. The correct use of the term Gentile is in question. It is a name that has been given us, not by ourselves, but by Jews, and it is by no means certain that it is accurately given. A very great chance exists that it is not. That, however, is a matter which Gentiles do not bother to understand. They think, of course, that if one is not a Jew, one must be a Gentile. This is only another instance of the Jewish view being, quote, put over, unquote, without the, quote, Gentile, quote, understanding or even questioning it. There is another difficulty. How shall one address Gentiles collectively? When one addresses Jews, he knows that the Jew is always a Jew, that every Jew acknowledges every other Jew, that Jews understand each other and are loyal to each other as against outsiders, quote unquote, that they think together and act together, that they stand together for Jewish defense, no matter how just the charge brought against them. When you address Jews, you address a unit, and when you discuss Jews, you get a united reaction from them. This cannot be said of Gentiles. They are of many races, many nationalities, many religions, many tongues. They never think of themselves as being united under the name Gentiles. They are not race or class conscious. Certainly they do not think of themselves as a unit, with reference to Jews as an opposite unit. Gentiles cannot be organized into one group nationally, let alone internationally, as Jews can. Jews of every shade of opinion, of every degree of religion and of unreligion, that is, atheist, can unite all around the world and do unite, having their own news service, their own telegraph service, their own foreign department, as they themselves describe it, by which they keep themselves united and informed for mass action. There is nothing even remotely approaching that among Gentiles. Not that this fact can be urged against the Gentiles as a fault. There are reasons why the Gentiles can never be united. And one reason is that, among the so-called Gentiles, there is a regnant superior strain that is not Gentile at all. No more is it Jewish. There are racial and moral strains among the non-Jewish sections of the world which can never be brought into agreement. And, outside this superior strain, among the Gentiles proper, the very basis for enduring union is lacked, or is lacking. So that the only union that can be expected is a union of the superior strain, which physically and morally is unconquerable, and whose task it is to liberate the lesser peoples who easily fall victims to subversion and have no reactive power to rescue themselves. It is to this human Gulf Stream that flows through the ocean of humanity, blessing it, that this address is offered. He's addressing from, I guess, some high, pure strain of the white race, I suppose, or at least of the Gentiles, are going to save the other lower Gentiles by explaining what's going on and leading the fight back. As to the identity of this section of humanity, quote, "He that hath ears to hear, let him hear. The others will not, because they cannot. There are many genuine Gentiles mixed up in our common population, but it is not to them that these words are offered." The Jewish question has existed for a long time, as the Jew knows and admits, and is a consequence of certain un-Jewish, or rather un-Israelitish, ideas held by Jewish persons of power. The disability under which the Jew labors is that he is not a Jew, properly speaking, and does not desire to be. Just at that point is the soil and the root of the Jewish question. Tackling the Jewish question is not congenial work. The race which this article now addresses has always shrunk from tackling it. Our race has little disposition to chastise any portion of humanity, to arouse feeling or resist it. We have little taste for this surgical work, which becomes absolutely necessary when certain corrupt influences deeply dislocate and seriously injure the common life. Nothing but a clear vision of the danger, nothing but an imperative sense of duty, would impel any one of us to embark on a course which is subject to misunderstanding and which must, in the nature of things, wait long for its complete justification. Our race is too fair, and has always been too fair, to enter into judgment, and upon this fairness and long-suffering, the offending groups have often seriously trespassed. Let's read this question again and just think about it. Tackling the Jewish question is not congenial work. That means it's unpleasant because there is power on the other side and there's ready retaliation, as he said at another point, which is why people shrink from criticizing Jews. The race, and he capitalizes race, which this article now addresses, has always shrunk from tackling it, which is not a good sign. And also, it's not clear who he's alluding to with this "the race," because I don't think at any point in this chapter he names it. Our race has little disposition to chastise any portion of humanity, to arouse feeling or resist it. We want to be left alone, more or less. We have a little taste for this surgical work, which becomes absolutely necessary when certain corrupt influences deeply dislocate and seriously injure the common life. And again, one of the most useful things about this whole set of writing on Jews or some of these phrases that can be reused at any point. This is why this is evergreen material that we do for the Learning College, because so long as Jews exist, they will cause exactly the same kind of problem. So that what he's talking about in 1920 remains true, and I'm talking to you, and it happens to be the year 2016, but it could be 3016 if they're not taken care of, or it could be 1715 or something. Doesn't matter, because they do the same things. Therefore, the same terms in criticizing them will be valid at any point. So anytime you find a good one, you put that into your quiver of phrases you can use to describe, to get others to understand what the Jews are doing. Here he says, they dislocate and seriously injure the common life. That's a very good phrase. They seriously injure the common life. Nothing but a clear vision of the danger, nothing but an imperative sense of duty, would impel any one of us to embark on a course which is subject to misunderstanding and which must, in the nature of things, wait long for its complete justification. Our race is too fair, and has always been too fair, to enter hastily into judgment. And upon this fairness and long-suffering, the offending groups have often seriously trespassed. They think they can get away with it because we're fair and we're slow to draw conclusions. Regarded by itself as a separate entity, the Jewish power is most impressive. International Jews today occupy literally every controlling lever of power. Every controlling lever of power. Building up for centuries, perfecting their teamwork from generation to generation, from country to country, they have practically reached the summit. Nothing but the Christian religion remains unvanquished by them, though through false liberalism, even that has felt the Jewish assault. So great is this power that the very knowledge of it kills hope that any movement can ever dislodge it. Earnest, honest men have walked around it, surveyed it, measured its strength, and have given up the dream of changing it. In Russia, they tried to segregate it, but while segregation went on from one side, infiltration proceeded from the other, and even the anti-Semitic Russian government was honeycombed with Jews, as the end showed. And again, there you go, you have a very nice parallel to Catholicism and its doctrine, which results in exactly the same thing. While the segregation, or at least spiritual or cultural segregation is attempted, the church says you can stop the Jews from molesting your culture. It doesn't matter because it doesn't define them correctly. They can't stop molesting our culture. So while one just sort of metaphysically tries to keep them separate, and remember, it was the Jews who wanted to be contained. The rabbis wanted the Jews contained in ghettos. So you can't even credit the church with physical segregation, as is usually done by the ignorant. Nevertheless, it was their spiritually, they wanted to keep their influence out. But while they're doing that, the Jews are inherently more aggressive in their culture, and the more aggressive is going to beat the less aggressive every time. It may take a little time to seep through, but eventually it does, and then it subverts whatever the institution is. Because Catholicism is not promoting, this is the one area where it is effectively pro-white, it's not promoting loose sex through most of its history, rather the opposite. But Jews always do that as sort of the linchpin of their policy for promoting general degeneracy and destroying society. So if you don't simply kill the Jews off, exterminate them, you're leaving them alive to use their powerful spy and infiltration network and commercial and financial network to undermine your society. This is why all the soft stuff does not work with Jews. They are not going to stop doing what they do or being what they are. Because you can't tell the singer from the song or the dancer from the dance in this instance. They've acted this way for thousands of years. Why would they change when it's brought them all the rewards, all the money in the world? And he says literally controlling every lever of power. He said that 100 years ago. So that today when I come to you, the Jews who control Germany and Europe are importing millions of their Syrian co-Semites into Europe, and they are raping and harassing and molesting, and ultimately they're going to outbreed the native Germans in order to finally end the white race for once and for all. So 100 years later, the Jews think they're an endgame. So the solutions that Ford is proposing are not strong enough. And it's my argument that nothing short of exterminating the Jews has any chance of success. Are they strong enough to prevent us from exterminating them? That's the only question that's really of interest. But that if we leave them, as he says, they've been perfecting this for centuries. They built up their networks. They know exactly what they're doing. That's why they look at the rest of us as children. And somehow here and there, one of us, like me or you or someone else, stumbles onto the facts of what's going on and wants to do something about it. But what can be done? You can't develop the knowledge and the know-how and the networks that they have overnight. The simplest solution is coming together and simply killing them off. And if there's another solution, no one has ever suggested it since I first proposed that a couple of years ago. They just affect to be horrified by it or think it's for shock value or whatever. But there is no other solution that I can see. You're not going to build a competing network with them. It's too late in the day. Now he says, building up for centuries, perfecting their teamwork from generation to generation, they have practically reached the summit. Nothing but the Christian religion remains unvanquished by them, though through false liberalism, even that has felt the Jewish assault. And remember, he's writing about 30, 40 years before Vatican II, when they, well, you would say that that was the turning point where they successfully completed their their subversion of the church from traditional sexual morality, etc., etc. So all of this was changing. They were taking power. So great is this power that the very knowledge of it kills hope that any movement can ever dislodge it. Earnest, honest men have walked around it, surveyed it, measured its strength, and have given up the dream of changing it. In Russia, they tried to segregate it, but while segregation went on from one side, infiltration proceeded with the other, or from the other, and even the anti-Semitic Russian government was honeycombed with Jews, as the end showed. In Germany, they endeavored to vote the Jewish power out of politics, only to find the root deep-set in finance, and no country has yet attacked the sacred image of gold. In England, the policy of absorption was adopted, and the result is that wherever a Jew was put in the power, the British Empire has reaped trouble. In Ireland, in India, in Palestine, the present vice-regents of all these possessions being Jews. Other little countries, exasperated beyond endurance, tried violence and failed just as miserably as the others. Why? Because every one of these methods is precisely the method that the Jew prefers to have people try. He knows their utility first. I'm sorry, he knows their futility first. They find it out later. And this really is true in I'm not talking about violence, but in terms of like the Jews know where certain types of thoughts will lead you. So that I've said probably before, but when I was a conservative, more of an individualist in college, and I was nevertheless always intellectually open to the truth, the facts, although I had been somewhat misled by, as I've said, professional right-wing writers who I later learned half of them were Jews as well, which I hadn't fully realized until I worked in it, but I got called a Nazi. Why is that? Because they know where certain types of realistic thinking lead. They lead you, if you're of a penetrating mind and you seek to discover the why rather than adopt fashionable whining about symptoms, which is practically the definition of conservatism, weak, tepid, useless, ineffectual, impotent conservatism, they know that you will eventually get onto them. And it's not that eventual. It happens fairly quickly if you're open to actually discovering that, oh, hey, I don't want to be a bull charging the cape. I want to find the matador who's wielding the cape. Say, why are our borders open? And if you penetrate through, you find, oh, gee, it wasn't big business. It wasn't the left. It was Jews deliberately trying to racially murder the country. And so the Jew is well aware of the reactions to him, the possible scope of reactions, and he has plans for all of them. And Ford says that violence doesn't work. He says that Jews know this. He knows the futility of this method first. They find it out later. He knows how these methods positively help him. They discover that later. Now, I think Ford's a little bit spitting in the wind here. Violence can work against Jews, and I'm arguing that there is no other way that does work. Ford is still spitting in the wind, thinking that exposing the Jew is enough. But we know with 100 years retrospect, it's not enough. The knowledge thus won would be pure gain, were it not that it also seems to discourage the hope of men who know how seriously wrong the situation is. Behind this massive array of power, immovable as it appears, there is the veil cast over the Christian mind as to the supposedly peculiar destiny of, quote, God's chosen people, unquote. The Christian cannot read the Bible except through Jewish spectacles and therefore reads it wrong. The idea of the chosen people is one of the two great biblical ideas, but that the Jews constitute this chosen people is entirely opposed to the statement of the Bible, even of the Bible which the Jews acknowledge, the Old Testament of the Christians. The blessings of world possession, world rule, superior population, commercial greatness, military power, constituted governments, a great nation and a company of nations, all of these means by which to spread light and healing among nations were truly promised to one people, to Israel, not to Judah. Judah's destiny was to be quite different. Very few Bible readers ever note the distinction between the house of Israel and the house of Judah, yet this distinction was marked from the time of Jacob. The prophets absolutely insist upon it. Israel seceded from Judah, being unable to live with that people any longer. Israel's destiny took them out into the world, and if the Bible be true, then Israel's destiny of greatness is being fulfilled in Israel, not in Judah. The two houses are distinct to this day, although a future reunion, a spiritual reunion, is promised to come. Yet the false idea that the Jews constitute all Israel has penetrated the Christian consciousness to an alarming extent, so that when the Jewish press insists, as it does every week, "We gave you your God, we gave you your Bible, we gave you your Christ," even Christian ministers cannot find an answer. The answer is that the Old Testament is 9/10 an Israelitish book and not a Jewish book. 9/10 an Israelitish book and not a Jewish book. Abraham was not a Jew. Isaac was not a Jew. Jacob was not a Jew. Moses was not a Jew. Joshua was not a Jew. Gideon was not a Jew. Samuel was not a Jew. Even Esther and Mordecai were not Jews, but Benjamites. The majority of the prophets were not Jews, but Israelites. Upon the coming of Judah into power, in the persons of David and Solomon, the misrule was so great that Israel seceded, and the secession was sanctioned by the prophets. In the New Testament, Jesus Christ found his disciples in Galilee, far out of Judea, and of them there was but one tribe, Judas, whose name indicates that he was a Jew. St. Paul was of the tribe of Benjamin, the light tribe, which was left with Judah, quote, "for a light." But there is a constant pattern of preaching, the Russellites making it the great theme, that the Jews are to rule the world because it is so prophesied. The amazing blindness with which Christians have regarded the open pages of their Bible is the only explanation of this one-sided teaching, which is confusing to the Christians and exceedingly dangerous to the Jews. In the Bible, Israel is the chosen people of blessing, and the time is announced when Judah shall walk to Israel and recognize them and become one with them. There is a chosen racial breed, a select seed, a superior strain of blood and soul in the world, but it is not Judah. One thing, therefore, that Christians can do as a contribution to the solution of the Jewish question is to read their Bibles carefully. The Jewish question will be solved, and its solution will begin in the United States, but that does not mean that it will come as the result of a popular movement. Great changes did not occur that way. It makes little difference whether the mass of the people see the question or not. The mass of the people are not always called into such matters. Their work is to hold the world steady while the change takes place. But a sufficient number of qualified persons have seen the question to ensure that now the era of solution has set in. The timid, the soft literary men in pulpits, with whose ilk Jeremiah had a keen acquaintance, the false preachers of peace, peace, the hush brothers and sisters of every name, the shallow shouters for fairness, and all who are afraid of the truth in its surgical forms, these have no place in the healing of the hurt of these times. They are wedded to their softness. Nothing has been more shameful in the last 2 years than the spectacle of men bidding for the applause of bootleggers and gamblers and the lecherous masters of the modern stage and the sinister Kahila and the anti-Christian American Jewish Committee because, forsooth, someone has fulfilled the duty to tell the truth. However, these things must always be, and the evil influences among the Jews have learned just what kind of help they may expect and from what kind of people. They know how to bribe. They know how to sense who's soft and will do their bidding for money. The Dearborn Independent has not been making a fight, but fulfilling a duty to shed light on a matter crying for light. The Dearborn Independent, therefore, has never urged any individual or organization to join it in this work, nor has it charged with cowardice those who, for prudential or other reasons, have kept silent. Editors especially have been absolved. Not one of them was asked to lend his aid Although the files of this office hold thousands of written assurances from newspapermen all over the land, from all parts of the world, testifying to the truth of our statements. Organizations have been proposed for various purposes. Strong organizations have offered themselves as vehicles for the carrying out of any plan the Dearborn Independent might propose. But all such undertakings have been avoided. Our belief being that simply to state the truth and let it work its own right will was sufficient at this. Somehow I misread that. It's kind of an odd statement. I think there's a word missing there, but maybe not. All such undertakings have been avoided. He's saying that they haven't signed up with any organization, that they have all kinds of verification of their claims from editors all over the land, but they've done it purely independently. They've done it not soliciting any violence or making any using any curses, but simply laid the facts out there in the belief that simply to state the truth and let it work its own way would be... Oh, okay, it's just a phrase I'm unfamiliar with. Let it work its own right will. Our belief being that simply to state the truth and let it work its own right will was sufficient at this time. So they're saying, we really believe that just laying the facts out there would be enough and letting them have the effect they would have, work its own right will. And to that belief and policy, we have adhered. But what shall we do is the constant question. How shall we balk this system which surrounds us and infects so much of our common life? Observe it, identify it, eschew it. That's avoid it. That is more powerful than active opposition. The clear eye of the man who sees and understands is something that even the evil powers of Jewry cannot endure. But the most potent action any awakened person can take is this, to erect again our own moral landmarks, which the Oriental Jewish invasion has broken down. This would spell sheer doom to the whole evil system sponsored by the Jews. And this, of course, which has never been tried, this is the course which has never been tried, to go back to the principles which made our race great, the principles to which we have been recreant and therefore have fallen an easy prey. This is the only invincible course. It is an opposition which evil Jews cannot understand and cannot defeat. In place of doing business, which the way of doing business which Jewish dealers have introduced, let the businessmen of the country adopt the old way of the white man, when a man's word was as good as his bond, and when business was service and not exploitation. Let the men and women of the country learn how to buy. Let them learn how to test quality in fabric and food, instead of being dependent on price tags. The merchandising practices of this country in the hands of ruthless exploiters have all but ruined honest merchants. Let any dweller in a great city recall the last 20 years how the Christian merchants have been growing fewer and fewer. Why? Is it because the owners of Jewish department stores are better businessmen? No. The Jewish merchants began the practice of filling their store windows with goods that looked like the goods in reputable merchants' windows and sold them for a much lower price. The helpless public, no longer able to determine the quality of goods, and guided solely by price tags, flocked to the Jew's store. The result is that one hears everywhere in ordinary conversation the complaint that, quote, everything is shoddy. Of course it is, and it will remain so until we educate people in the art of buying. That of itself will break down 3/4 of the abuses practiced in the commercial world today. Another contribution that can be made to the defeat of Jewish subversive influence is the examination of the so-called liberal ideas, their source, their effect, their whole tendency. Men are thinking ideas today that poison them, morally, socially, and economically. These ideas are deliberately shot into society as poison gas was shot into the ranks of soldiers in France. Our mental hospitality has been grossly abused. The public mind has been made a sewer. The time has come for a custom barrier to be raised for the examination of imported ideas. Unrestricted immigration of ideas has been as bad for American mentality as unrestricted immigration of people has been for American society. Interesting way of putting it. We have taken our amusements without thought of what was behind them in the way of deliberate intent to make us common and careless and coarse. We have read our newspapers wholly innocent of the propaganda mixed with the news. We have even taken our religion in a Judaized form without troubling to inquire whether it squared with the Bible, the textbook of religion. We have read our novels and have failed to see what serum the author was injecting along with his story. And all this has been possible because we have been asleep, enjoying, as we thought, a life which was swiftly taken from us, and dreaming that the old principles still held sway. It is perfectly obvious that the cure for all this is to become awake, alert, to challenge the foreign influence, and to seek out again the principles that gave us our greatness. We have been weaned away from our natural leaders. We have been taught to look to those who cannot speak our language and who do not hold our institutions dear. A people that turns from its own leaders, or a people whose leaders have been turned from the sacred responsibilities of the high office of leading, is in a precarious position and becomes an easy victim to confusion of soul. There is a dearth of voices in the land today. The prophets are dumb or reading beautiful essays to the people. Suspicion has been sowed like darnel seed between classes of the same race. The people have been broken up, and the subversive Jewish influence supports the oligarchy of unserviceable wealth at one end of the social scale, while it stimulates the baser elements of industrial unrest at the other end. And the race thus rent asunder to its own undoing does not see this. Capital does not see, and labor does not see, that the leaders of chaos are alien in blood and soul. To keep American and Christian the school, the church, the legislature, the jury room, and the government is the most potent resistance that can be made to the evil influences that have been upon us and that this series of articles has partly uncovered. The strength of all subversive influence is in proportion as we cease to be what we ought to be. The evil influences surrounding this people can succeed only as they change this people into something less than it ought to be. Therefore, to go back to the old landmarks, whereby we made all the progress we ever made, is not only the part of wisdom, but the need of the hour. The school must be cleansed. The jury box must be kept inviolate. Trial by jury has almost disappeared in Jewish New York. The church must be un-Judaized and Christianized. The government must be Americanized. Let there be the utmost freedom of thought and speech, but let there be also, with it, a discrimination which will prevent the people from being victimized by every spurious idea, every gold brick economic proposal which comes along. It needs only that men be awake to their better interests and to leave no place in their scheme of life for the practices which destroy the very foundations of confidence. Surely it must be understood by this time that the Jews rule not by reason of their brilliance or their money, but by ideas which are not even properly Jewish, but Babylonian. They have captured the castle from within. They have been able to do so only because of our ignorance of the lineage and dignity of the stock of ideas upon which our civilization has been founded. Our people needs to engraft itself again onto the parent tree and draw again the sustenance which made it great and fruitful. Many so-called Gentiles are somewhat affected by the Jews' wails of persecution. This has been sufficiently discussed in previous articles, but Gentiles can further contribute to the solution of the Jewish question by looking about them to see if they can discover any evidence of persecution here, unless it be persecution of the Christians by the organized agencies of the Jews. In this month's Atlantic Monthly, a Jewish rabbi, who undoubtedly knows better, assumes that his race is a hated race. He rather enjoys the thought and accepts it as a distinctive honor. Our Gentile might also observe how untrue this is, how indeed in this mixture of nations the Jew gets off with less, even of the harmless kind of racial animosity, than any other foreign admixture. Above all, the Gentile, so-called, who in 90 cases out of every 100 is no Gentile at all, as the Jews may well admit, will do well to avoid fear. Nothing is more abject than the fear of the Jew, and nothing more disastrous to the Jew than the tactics he employs to sustain that fear. The Jewish subversive power has been powerful only for evil, and only where there was a disposition to evil. It has never yet succeeded in bringing shame or confusion to the right. Indeed, there is one sure way of gaining the respect of the Jew, and that is, tell the truth. Capital letters, tell the truth. No one knows better than the Jew whether statements made about Jews are true or not. Gentiles may never be certain whether a statement made about the Jews may be relied upon, but Jews always know. That is why prejudice, abuse, hatred, scorn, ridicule, false charges roll off them as water off a duck. The Jews have never in all their history feared the lies of their enemies, but they have feared the truth. But why would their enemies need to lie about the Jews given what they're doing? What examples do you have historically of people lying about Jews? And if they only fear the truth in the ancient sense, not to be afraid of it, but to fear to violate it, and to fear to have the truth testify against them, then the day of Judah's return to standing has come. The truth is Judah's friend, and Israel's friend, and the world's friend. It makes hard demands. It is sometimes not easy to speak, and harder still to hear, but the truth heals, as Judah is due to discover. Are they due, though? And now we move on to the last page, the last three, four paragraphs of the series. There is this to say, that among the many thousands of persons who have written to the Dearborn Independent, confirming out of their own observation and experience the statements made in this series of articles, there has been a most gratifying absence of the spirit of violence. At the beginning, a few rabid Jew-baiters made themselves known and expressed their hope that at last a regular program of pogroms was to be instituted. We never knew how far these advances were made with the knowledge of the Jewish leaders, that is, they may have been put them up to it. But we do know that for a year and a half in the United States, the Jewish press and Jewish thugs and Jewish politicians and even some of the most respectable of the Jewish organizations did their utmost, and in some of the strangest ways, to compel this study of the Jewish question to lead into violence and disorder. There was nothing that the Jewish leaders more desperately desired or more tirelessly worked for. That was their first setback. Everywhere else in the world, they had always been able to foment this sort of thing and label it anti-Semitism. The label anti-Semitism is one of their choicest weapons in their Jewish armory. But in the U.S., their plan failed. It is their first notification that in this country, the question is going to be solved. It is not going to be given a new lease of life by following the old mistakes. The Dearborn Independent knows the temper of the American people in this question, that it is cool, fair, and somewhat more determined than it formerly was. But the Jews know this temper better than anyone else. Hence the magnitude and superb rashness of the propaganda with which they are literally flooding the country. The Dearborn Independent is grateful for the flood of Jewish propaganda. It has served in hundreds of important cases to give the confirmation to our statements which was wanted. Jewish literature has been a powerful informer of the gravity of the Jewish question in the United States. The result was not what the Jewish leaders wished, of course, but it was serviceable to the truth just the same. Now that the question is open, now that the press is able to print, quote, Jew, unquote, when necessary, now that a bunch of keys has been provided by which the people may unlock doors and make further inquiries, the Dearborn Independent will follow other aspects of the question, discussing them from time to time as circumstances may warrant. Now that we've opened it up, everyone can eat what we provided, and we will continue to deal with this as it matters. And that was printed as, I guess, the final on the 14th of January, 1922. At least that was the latest date that we saw out of all these 80 articles. And so that concludes our audiobook of the Dearborn Independence, which is Henry Ford's The International Jew, unabridged version, the international Jew, the world's foremost problem. And what can we say in summing it up? Well, he provides all kinds of useful phrases, which I've included in the notes that go along with each chapter that we've read, that are perfect for repetition because they will still. This material is completely evergreen. That's why we read it 100 years later or 95 years later, and it still sounds exactly the same because the Jews are even more entrenched in power. As he says, they perfect their networking and they perfect their techniques from generation to generation, so they're always getting, they're not just way ahead of us, they're farther ahead of us. And he concludes with, in my opinion, a rather Sunday schoolish view that all we need to do is go back to our original principles and stay true to them, and we'll defeat the Jew, and that violence doesn't work. I don't agree with that. I think entirely what we can say 100 years later is that essentially the Jews were already more powerful at the period these articles were written than Henry Ford even realized. Even given his saying that they literally controlled every lever of power in the world at that time, which is pretty darn amazing. But they're even more powerful than that. We have to form, it's my view, a Team White. And ultimately, this is not preaching violence against this person or that. It's simply saying, as an intellectual matter, the only way to defeat the Jews is to exterminate them. Their culture is miles ahead of ours in terms of networking. They have a genetic cultural loyalty that white men simply do not possess. Whites are natural infighters. They are naturally more disloyal to their own kind, even though they prefer their own kind. That's a bit of a paradox. And so we have to use our unique ways in order to find a solution to this. For whites who don't want to be bred out of existence, as the Jews are currently trying to do, as sort of their end game, their soft genocide for our people, which is not all that soft, but it's the way that seems better to them after they discarded the USSR, and now they've moved on to the USA as their full headquarters, as Ford was suggesting would happen or was starting to happen 100 years ago. USA is the center of their actions, and they're trying to genocide all the white Western nations and destroy their homogeneity so that Judaism will have no white opponent any longer. Encouraging our people not to breed, encouraging them to breed when they do with non-whites. All this and everything that he described, what would Henry Ford think about the world we have today? Rather than going back to our original principles of pure, honest morality, etc., we've gone quite the opposite direction. And so it's 100 years later, it's 100 times worse, wouldn't you say? So whites who are determined to continue to exist as whites must form a team, and it's my view that the only solution that can work is exterminating the Jew. And that's where I'm going to conclude. I want to thank you for being with me and listening to all these chapters of The International Jew. I think we've now completed maybe 10 or 12 audiobooks. They're actually listed at alexlinder.com. Varg put up a nice page. But everything that we recorded will always be found first and foremost at vnnforum.com. So thanks for listening to me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.